Hello, my name is Karen, and I'm a survivor of sexual assault. In June 1994, I received a telephone call from a woman who claimed to have had a relationship with my husband, Ron. When Ron came home, I confronted him, and an argument followed. Later that night, the woman called again, wanting to know if I was okay. She explained that Ron had physically been abusive to her on more than one occasion, and she worried that if I told him about our earlier conversation, he would hurt both of us. I could hear the fear in her voice. I was sitting on my bed at the time, wearing only a T-shirt and underwear, and my husband was next to me. I tried to keep the conversation from him, answering in monosyllables. But when I hung up the phone, I could see that Ron was angry. He looked at me with hatred in his eyes, and he said, "Oh, so the two of you are plotting against me. I ought to punch you in your face, break your jaw, and you can call and tell her all about it." I looked him straight in the eye and said evenly, "If you put your hands on me, it won't be her I'll be calling. It will be the police." He turned away from me and reached into the nightstand on his side of the bed. When he turned back, there was a knife in his hand. He put the knife up to my face and dared me to repeat what I had just said. I refused to answer him. After what seemed like an eternity, he turned away from me and put the knife back in the drawer. I lied and said that I had to go to the bathroom. I slid off the bed, reached for my pocketbook, and ran out of my apartment barefoot. I didn't stop running until I had reached the police station 2 blocks away. To this day, I don't know why Ron didn't follow me. I was a sight arriving at the police station dressed only in my T-shirt and underwear. I asked the police to return with me to my home. The front door was open. The lights were on. Ron was gone, and so was the knife. The next day, I went to family court and got an order of protection. The judge ordered that Ron be removed from the apartment. Later that day, the police came and escorted him from our home. A few weeks later, I woke up on a sunny Saturday morning. When I opened my bedroom door, Ron was standing there, wearing only plaid boxer shorts. In his right hand was the same knife. In his left hand were 2 black ropes. He told me to lie down on the bed. When I said no, he punched me with the closed fist in the middle of my chest with such force that I was knocked backward onto the bed. He placed one of his knees on each of my upper arms, pinning me down. When I started to cry and scream, he took the scarf off my head and stuffed it in my mouth. In my dresser drawer, he found a pair of black pantyhose, cut them in half with the knife, and tied my ankles to the footboard. I was tied, spread eagle, to my own bed in my own home. He stepped out of his boxer shorts, climbed onto the bed, cut off my underwear with the knife, and raped me. I remember the actual rape as if I'd been floating above my bed, watching the scene from the ceiling. He kept jabbing at me with the knife, saying, "This is all your fault. You should have let me come home. What happens between a man and his wife is nobody's business." I thought, if I move, the knife is going to slip and I will die. After he raped me, he walked over to the hamper, pulled out a T-shirt, and wiped himself off. I made myself pay attention to his every action, aware that I would need evidence. I looked at the VCR to see what time it was. I observed what clothes he was wearing and what kind of sneakers he put on. I watched everything he did. Ron got dressed, removed my gag, and asked me where my pocketbook was. He wanted money. I lied and told him I left it at my girlfriend's house. I lied again when I said that I needed to call my girlfriend and tell her not to come over. I told him that we had made plans to go shopping that day, and I didn't want her to come to my house. He untied me and let me use the phone. I couldn't call for help as he stood over me with the knife while I made the phone call. I called my best friend, and I told her not to come over. Of course, she had no idea what I was talking about, but she could tell I was crying. When she asked me if I was all right, I said no. Intuitively, she asked me if Ron was there. I said yes. And she asked to speak to him on the phone. I gave the phone to him and moved away from the bed. I couldn't hear all that he said to her, but I could see that he was crying too. While Ron spoke on the phone, I thought about ways to escape. But my front door was locked from the inside with the key, and the key was in my pocketbook in the closet. It would have been impossible for me to run to the closet, find my key, unlock the door, and escape without Ron catching up to me. And he still had that knife. I simply moved away from him. After he hung up the phone, he turned to me and asked if I were okay. This angered me as much as the rape did. I remember saying, "You'll have to kill me before I ever let you touch me again." He simply laughed and went downstairs into the kitchen. When I heard him open the refrigerator door, I picked up the phone and called 911. I remember whispering hysterically, "My husband's in the house. He raped me. He has a knife. Please send the police." The 911 operator was calm. She asked all the appropriate questions and tried to calm me down. She told me several times not to hang up, that the police were on the way. When I heard the door slam shut, I panicked and hung up the phone. I never told the operator who I was or where I lived. Within 2 minutes, the police arrived. Ron had run out the back door. I remembered that a red light on my kitchen telephone lights up whenever another extension is in use. Ron must have seen the light and known I was calling the police. 5 minutes after the police arrived, I heard a car door slam and the police say, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but you can't go in there. It's a crime scene." I heard my best friend's voice, and I was able to convince the police to let her come in. As a nurse, I knew the importance of immediate medical care and evidence collection after a rape. I showed the police the ropes and the pantyhose that were still tied to the bed. I showed them the T-shirt that Ron had used to wipe himself off. Finally, the police let my friend take me to the hospital. At the time of the assault, I was the head nurse of an emergency department near my home. I decided not to go to the hospital where I worked because I didn't want my staff to have to do a rape exam on their supervisor. Instead, I went to another local hospital, but I was immediately left alone in a cubicle. The doctor who came to examine me did not speak to me or even acknowledge my presence. He walked over to the counter, picked up the rape kit, and began to read the directions. I knew then that I was in trouble. I convinced the doctor to let me show him how to use the kit since I had assisted with several rape exams in the past. That's right. I had to show the doctor how to collect my own evidence. The few months after the rape were the worst of my life. I thought they would never catch Ron, and if they did, I believed he would never be convicted. To this day, many people don't believe that a husband can be guilty of rape against his wife. It was a long time before I regained my appetite and was able to get a good night's sleep. I still can't sleep without the TV on. I'm afraid of the silence. I set the timer so the TV goes off long after I'm asleep. I was lucky that my husband was eventually brought to trial. During the trial, he was arrested for criminal possession of a controlled substance, and a bargain was struck. He pleaded guilty to first-degree rape in order to get a reduced sentence on both charges. Just before I was due to take the stand to testify, he changed his plea from not guilty to guilty and was subsequently sentenced to 3 to 9 years in May of 1995. Ron went to prison in August of that year. He came before the parole board 3 times but was denied parole each time. After serving 7 of the 9 years in prison, Ron was released in the spring of 2002, and he was released from parole last year after completing the remaining 2 years of his sentence as a parolee. Because he's free, I'm often asked why I choose to remain in the same house, in the same city. But I do so because I've resolved not to give him any more power over my life. My friends and my family are here, my life is here, and I love my job. He will not make me flee. The rape and its aftermath gave me the will, strength, and ability to become an advocate for other survivors. As a result of my experience at the hospital, I became trained as a forensic nurse examiner, and I now coordinate the local sexual assault nurse examiner SANE program. A SANE nurse is a specially trained RN who provides an objective, comprehensive assessment of patients who report that they've been raped or sexually assaulted. In addition, we oversee the collection of physical evidence from the victim's body. We are experts in providing care for these very special patients. We also provide testimony in court about the evidence collection process and any injuries that we've documented. I have made it my mission to see that no patient in my county is re-victimized by the medical exam that occurs in the hospital. My commitment to direct service and advocacy encompasses both my private and professional lives. In addition to seeing patients in a clinical setting, I work for a nonprofit community-based organization that provides a wide range of services to victims of crime, including community outreach and rape awareness education. I volunteer for numerous local, state, and international organizations, and I've recently joined a local sexual assault response team that provides forensic examiners to public hospitals in my area. Not only do such programs provide compassionate care to sexual assault victims, they're instrumental in helping to hold perpetrators accountable for their actions. In addition, my outreach work allows me to educate others about sexual assault, forensic nursing, and related topics. I've appeared on television talk shows and in film documentaries. I've testified before Congress and appeared before state and federal agencies. Tragedy can be turned into triumph. Survivors of sexual assault can and must be heard through poetry, art, music, or public speaking. We can each work toward prevention of sexual assault, and we can provide support for victims in our own way by volunteering in a shelter or on a hotline, or perhaps by pursuing a career in medicine, law, or social services. In a culture where rape depends on a conspiracy of silence, survivors who speak out heal more than themselves.